Hello, excuse me. Hello, today is April 8th, 2026. Following is a 60-minute reading coming to you from the Talking Information Center featuring the latest edition of Time Magazine. My name is Fred. From the brief section, the brief opener. On day one, Trump urged the great, proud people of Iran to take over your government. Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu echoed the call in Persian, saying, "Do not let this opportunity slip away." Inside Iran, the response has been, "How?" Over decades, the Islamic Republic built a system designed not just to crush dissent, but to prevent it from cowering in the first place. Surveillance is pervasive, opposition networks are infiltrated, and organizers disappear. "They've killed a lot of people," says Roya Buromand, who, with her sister, founded the Abdurrahman Buromand Center for Human Rights in Iran, a Washington, D.C. nonprofit tallying the regime's victims. They've focused their energy on preventing their opponents from getting organized. When the U.S.-Israeli assault began on February 28th, the center's staff was still trying to determine how many people were killed the last time Iranians attempted what Trump and Netanyahu are now urging. In January, throngs took to the street armed only with the belief that sheer numbers could topple the regime. If that sounds naively hopeful, it once worked. In 1979, millions of Iranians filled the streets as part of the Islamic Revolution that culminated in the overthrow of the Pahlavi monarchy. But those protests were mounted by organized groups, and the National Army had declared it would no longer fire on its own people. The faction of activists and clerics that ultimately took power promptly established a regime committed to preventing such mobilization from ever happening again. The state was very aware of how the Shah fell. Buromand notes they have made sure that if they have a legitimacy problem, there is no one to fill that vacuum. First, there was hunting. Back in the 80s and 90s, there were a lot of assassinations, explains Mehdi Yahyandejad, an Iranian activist in the U.S. They removed important figures outside Iran. Shabor Bakhtiari, a former prime minister who attempted to organize opposition in exile, was stabbed to death in Paris in 1991. A regime hit squad also killed an associate of his, Abdurrahman Buromand, whose daughters would go on to count assassinations abroad. The current tally, 457, does not include failed attempts like the one involving a Hell's Angels member who, after being hired in 2023 to kill an Iranian exile in Maryland, was arrested before he could fulfill a vow to erase his head from his torso. Nor does it count the three attempts to kill anti-regime activist Masi Alanjad. Buromand once recalled how, after a hitman was photographed on the porch of Alanyad's Brooklyn home, people were crying in like Canada, saying, "We are safe nowhere." Iran, inside Iran, the warnings are even clearer. In the chain murders of the 1990s, dissent intellectuals were killed by axe, stage robbery, poison, and slit throats. In 1996, intelligence agents attempted to send a bus of writers over a cliff. A passenger grabbed the emergency brake after the driver leaped from the vehicle. In time, overt killings gave way to imprisonment. "They killed the writers before," a Tehran movie theater manager told me in 2004. "Now they put them in prison." In the section of Evin Prison, it's E-V-I-N, reserved for political prisoners, Interrogators pummeled human rights advocates, journalists, and union activists with questions calculated to display the state's seeming omniscience. They knew everything, my whole life. One of my translators explained after emerging from interrogation, when agents arrived to make an arrest, they seized phones and computers along with the suspect. If they just held you for a week, you would be in awe, says Saimak Namazi, a dual Iranian U.S. citizen who spent 8 years in even prison. Ordinary Iranians got the message as well. Attend a protest, and days later, a text message arrives. Is it really worth it? The regime's own paranoia is not entirely unfounded. After President George W. Bush launched a program to promote democracy in Iran, a handful of activists were invited to workshops in nearby Dubai. Three returned early to Tehran after realizing they were being taught to foment the kind of grassroots revolution that in the early 2000s toppled dictatorships in Serbia, Georgia, Ukraine, and Kyrgyzstan. Exactly what the regime was on the lookout for. Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei, a student of the downfall of the Soviet Union, was intent on undercutting the building blocks of democratic civil society from teachers' unions to an independent press. He also, after the stolen 2009 presidential election, signaled that the system was closed to reform, expanded security forces, including the head-cracking Baji militia. The tentacles of the police state are now reaching into the far corners of the country, says Huchang Chinhabi, professor emeritus of international relations at Boston University. I know people from rural areas of Iran who said, you know, in our village, we never had a presence of the government. We had a village mayor, and that was it. And now, 2 kilometers from the village, we have a little Baji base. As it stands, the most organized opposition groups may be factions that competed for power in 1979. Reza Pahlavi, eldest son of the overthrown Shah, has lived in exile in the U.S. for almost his entire life, but retains a presence in Iranian households via satellite television. His name is sometimes chanted at protests, and he has vowed to hold elections if returned to power. The Mojahedin-e-Khalik, known as the MEK, founded as a Marxist movement in lobbying abroad as the National Council of Resistance of Iran, announced a provisional government. But the group remains deeply unpopular inside Iran, having sided with Iraq during the 1980-1988 Iran-Iraq War. Kurdish militants and political groups concentrated in western Iran also represent a form of organized opposition. But their call for autonomous rule, if not an independent state, unnerves Iranians and raises fears of fragmentation given the presence of other ethnic minorities within Iran's borders. All the opponents have a long history of fighting one another as well as the regime. The war, however, has ignited an effort to forge a united front. The Iran Freedom Congress is scheduled to convene in London on March 28th and 29th. Preparations began between the January massacre of protesters and the February 28th start of the joint U.S.-Israeli air assault. It was something unique in Iranian politics, says Hossein Razaga, an Iranian journalist based in Europe who represented the most prominent political prisoners in talks to organize the Congress. There was no leak. After demonstrating that disparate groups can work together, Razag says democratic activists will welcome the help of any country and any international institution that would help them for a peaceful transition. But not, he says, military intervention. Zelensky's drone diplomacy. by Nandika Chatterjee and Richard Hall. It was just over a year ago that Trump told Volodymyr Zelensky that he didn't have the cards right now. Today, the war in Iran may have improved the Ukrainian president's hand. Iran's deployment of masses of low-cost drones to attack the Gulf and Israel, hitting oil infrastructure, U.S. bases and apartment buildings, has exposed a critical gap in the region's air defenses. While the countries on the receiving end of those attacks possess sophisticated missile defense systems like the U.S.-made Patriot, they have struggled to absorb the high volume of Iran's cheap, expendable, one-day Shahed attack drones. Ukraine has been fighting off those same drones for years. Ukrainian officials say Russia has fired tens of thousands of Shahed-type drones at its cities since Moscow launched its invasion in 2022. Out of necessity, Ukraine has developed a multi-layered network of drone defense that is suddenly in high demand. It combines radar detection, electronic jamming, and intercepted drones designed to hunt down Shaheds mid-air. Ukraine's expertise in this area has given Zelensky a diplomatic boost at a time when his country's armed forces are under pressure on the battlefield. And the U.S. has been pressing him to accept unfavorable ceasefire terms with Russia. Zelensky told Britain's parliament on March 17th that 11 countries, including the U.S., have asked Kyiv for help in combating the drones, and that 200 Ukrainian military advisors were already in the Middle East offering advice on how to defend against them. Agreements are already in place, he said. In a briefing in Kyiv on March 14th, Zelensky said Trump himself had expressed an interest in purchasing Ukraine's drone defense technology. Zelensky does not intend to give away this expertise for free. He has said that Ukraine is open to long-term deals that grant access to its drone defense in return for money and other weaponry its armed forces might need. Despite growing international interest in Ukraine's anti-drone technology, Trump has publicly downplayed the need for Kyiv's assistance. "We don't need their help in drone defense," Trump told Fox News Radio in an interview on March 13th. "We know more about drones than anybody." "Not true, Don." In a CNN interview on March 15th, Zelensky was asked if Trump's remarks suggested some resentment toward him. "I don't know," he responded. "Middle East countries in American bases, they need interceptors. It's drone interceptors. It's new technology. It's our technology." Could Iran retaliate on U.S. soil? This is a question and answer piece here, written by Connor Green. After the massive U.S.-Israeli air assault, Iran retaliated militarily across the Middle East, firing missiles and drones into a dozen countries since February 28th. But the regime also has a long history of mounting terror attacks. Asked in March whether Americans ought to worry about attacks at home, Don Trump told Time, "I guess." "Well, the threat is very significant," says John D. Cohen, who served as the Undersecretary for Intelligence and Analysis during the Obama administration. "The good news is that the level of understanding and sophistication, especially amongst U.S. state and local law enforcement, has increased dramatically over the last decade and a half." Time spoke to Cohen as well as Bruce R. Hoffman, a counterterrorism and insurgency expert who has served in advisory roles to multiple federal agencies, about what to know about the potential threat Iran poses. Question: what capability does Iran have to attack the U.S.? Cohen: Iran has created a global cyber attack capability, working closely with countries like Russia. It also has an extensive presence in Canada, Mexico, Central America, and South America. Hoffman: Over the decades, there have been reports and in some cases arrests of Iranian sleeper agents in the United States. However, over the past decade plus or so, it seems that those assets, if they did exist in the U.S., have atrophied. Question, compared with other wars the U.S. has been involved with, how is the threat different this time around? Hoffman answers, terrorism is now seen as one of many other threats to the United States. Consequently, over the past 8 years or so, we've seen resources, especially following the defeat of the ISIS caliphate, shifted away from counterterrorism to counterintelligence and to other threats. Are there scenarios you think are more likely than others? Cohen, experts that we worked with, they've always said that if you want to understand what Iran is going to do, look at what's being done to it. Iran has operational capabilities to attack the U.S. in several ways. Iran is typically very careful not to go beyond the tactics that have been employed against it. So as we're looking at the current conflict, we're seeing the targeting of government officials. We're seeing the targeting of petrochemical facilities. Those are examples of what we did to Iran. Does Iran have the infrastructure or intelligence to replicate U.S. attacks? Cohen, yes. Well, not on the same scale. Iran does have the operational capabilities to replicate many of the attack techniques used against it. It has an extensive global cyber capability. They've had over a decade to develop their playbook and incorporate emerging technologies such as AI and drones in their attack scenarios. Can you explain the threat of Iranian proxies to the U.S.? Cohen, Iran has strong financial and operational relationships with groups like Hezbollah, the Houthis in Yemen, Hamas, and even criminal organizations, where they will use these groups or operators associated with these groups to engage in acts of targeted violence or cyber attacks. What capability does Iran have to carry out drone strikes on the U.S.? Cohen. Iran has a significant presence in Mexico, Central America, South America, Canada, even the U.S., through its military and intelligence operatives, its proxies, its relationship with criminal organizations, in particular those operating south of the border. They have the flexibility to access the expertise, the personnel, the equipment to conduct a drone attack in the United States, and now they have the incentive. Hoffman, drones are easily transportable, so they could be brought into the country, smuggled across the borders. I think that there's a range of possibilities. Next up, what's the political cost of pricey oil in an election year? This piece is by Philip Elliott. If Republicans can't get their arms around the spiraling costs of oil, they might need to get familiar with the new greeting. Hello, Speaker Hakeem Jeffries. The joint U.S.-Israeli strikes against Iran brought the single biggest disruption to oil in history. Markets responded rationally with panic. A gallon of gas was up almost 50 cents in the first week as the White House offered confoundingly mixed, garbled messages about what this war might or when this war might end or what would be considered a victory. The metric Trump offered on March for the war's end, when he feels it in my bones, he said. I'll know because I feel it in my bones. Republicans' hopes of holding on to their slim majority in the House and Senate may end up hinging on the cost at the pump when voting starts in just a few months. And the math is pretty clear. There is a correlation between the cost of oil and losses endured by the party running the White House. The pattern can be seen going back half a century. The government's own energy think tank is warning costs are going to stay up at least into 2027. In the last three midterms in which the price of oil was, adjusted for inflation, hovering around or about $100 a barrel at this point in the cycle, the party in the White House lost 29 House seats on average, according to a Time analysis. Speaker Mikey Johnson can afford to lose just one vote to keep his gavel. Trump's salvation may be that it's only spring. When oil prices slide lower as it gets closer to Election Day, as they did in 2014 and 2022, wave elections can end up blunted. But the numbers we're seeing now offer little comfort for GOP strategists hoping to ride out this Middle East turmoil. They've gone up probably less than I thought they'd go up, Trump said on March 9th as he faced a brutal grilling about oil prices that could upend the economy in the last 2 years of his political power. The calendar year began with oil at $57 a barrel. Analysts warn it could cost triple that by the end of March if the Iran conflict continues to clog the Strait of Hormuz, a route that sees about one-fifth of the world's crude oil production. Republicans can't help but notice the peril. In 2010, oil in today's dollars reached $113 in March of that midterm. Democratic President Barack Obama saw his party lose 64 seats. 4 years later, things looked just as bad for Obama when crude that March hit $132 in today's money. Oil prices fell closer to Election Day, but Obama lost 13 more seats. Trump's last midterm election in 2018 was more of a mixed bag. At this point in the cycle, oil was at just $79 in today's dollars. But prices rose from March to September when voters started paying attention to elections. Trump lost 42 allies in the House but picked up seats in the Senate. Nimble messaging cannot mask the hard truths of commodity prices. Senate Majority Leader John Thune conceded on March 9th that the price of gas is always kind of a benchmark and said politicians need to hear voters' concerns. But there wasn't much that could be done about it with the Strait of Hormuz impassable. To be fair, presidents typically get disastrous midterm report cards from voters. Since the Great Depression, only two midterms have shown positive trends for the party in the White House. The impeachment-weary 1998 electric that let President Bill Clinton's party pick up four House seats in the post-9/11-2002 midterms gave President George W. Bush a net 8 seats. Otherwise, the history is a parade of solid rejections of the party in power. In this election cycle, the greatest unknown may be not Trump's metrics, but Iran's awareness of the pain it can do economically. The Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, IRGC, embraces asymmetrical warfare. Closing the strait has figured in its battle plans for decades. Experts warn that even if mines are removed, Iran may find other ways to unsettle the maritime insurers who ultimately decide where ships venture. On March 11, an IRGC spokesman said, expect oil at $200 per barrel. Okay, switching gears. After youth-led protests, Nepal voters Nepal votes for rapper to be next leader. Balendra Shah, a 35-year-old rapper turned politician, could soon be Nepal's next prime minister. After his party won a sweeping parliamentary majority in the March 5th elections, Shah's Rashtriya Swatantra Party, RSP, formed 4 years ago, dominates the lower but more powerful chamber, having secured 182 of the 275 seats. Kathmandu's former mayor, more popularly known as Balen, campaigned on being unbeholden to the Nepali political establishment. Stunning upset. The RSP's rise is a marked shift for the small Himalayan country of 30 million wedged between India and China. Power in Nepal has largely rotated between major parties for decades. But the discontent over perceived corruption among political elites boiled over in September when young Gen Z protesters took to the streets and stormed federal buildings. At least 77 people died in the violence. And then Prime Minister K.P. Sharma Oli was forced to resign. Socially conscious rapper Shah stands out among Nepali politicians not only for his signature black rectangular glasses, but also for his roots in hip-hop, reportedly inspired by American musicians Tupac Shakur and Curtis 50 Cent Jackson. While pursuing studies in engineering, Shah was already making an impression in Nepal's hip-hop scene, both online and on the streets in the early 2010s, with lyrics reflecting Nepali social issues like poverty and income inequality. Face of a new direction. Shah's tenure as mayor of Kathmandu from 2022 to earlier this year was defined by a massive cleanup campaign that earned him both praise and criticism. His anti-establishment confrontational approach to government made him the face of the protests last year, which he said he backed. Sujeev Shakya, who chairs Kathmandu-based think tank Nepal Economic Forum, says he expects that as Prime Minister, Shah will take transparency to a different level. Milestones. Passed housing bill in the Senate. By an overwhelming bipartisan vote, 89-10, the Senate passed a sweeping piece of legislation, March 12th, that seeks to bolster the U.S. housing supply and lower costs for homebuyers. If the 21st Century Road to Housing Act passes the House, it would be the largest housing package to be signed into law in decades, though it faces an uncertain path because of opposition within both parties. Primary objectives of the bill include relaxing regulations to boost home building, mitigating costs for homeowners and buyers, and prohibiting institutional investors from buying single-family homes, a move that resembles Trump's January executive order directing a similar ban, though experts have said it's likely to have limited impact on reducing home prices. Milestones continued. One, an Oscar for Gerald Akapaw, pioneering cinematographer. Autumn Gerald Akapaw made history at the 98th Academy Awards on March 15th when she took home the Oscar for Best Cinematography for the movie Sinners. Only three women have previously been nominated in the category, all of them in the past decade. Rachel Morrison for Mudbound in 2018, Ari Wegner for The Power of the Dog in 2022, and Mandy Walker for Elvis in 2023. I really want all women in the room to stand up, Gerald Akapaw said. I feel like I don't get here without you guys. You women. Best Cinematography was a tight race this year. Many predicted a win for One Battle After Another's Michael Bauman, who received the American Society of Cinematography's top prize earlier in award season, an honor that has preceded an Oscar win in 6 of the past 10 years. The world of cinematography is even more male-dominated than directing. In 2025, women made up 13% of directors of the 250 top-grossing films, according to a study, by San Diego State University. Just 7% of cinematographers on those films were women. So when presenter Demi Moore read Gerald Acopa's name, the reaction in the room was electric. In her speech, Gerald Acopa thanked pioneering women in her field, including Ellen Krass, who shot Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. The award also recognizes Sinner's cinematographer's own pioneering achievement as the first female cinematographer to shoot on IMAX 65 millimeter and Ultra Panavision, which involves wielding two gigantic and incredibly loud cameras. Gerald Acopa dedicated much of his speech to Sinner's writer-director Ryan Coogler, whom she called a very honorable person. The two previously collaborated on Black Panther, Wakanda Forever. Before that, Gerald Acopa worked on the Marvel Cinematic Universe TV series Loki, which earned her an Emmy nomination. She is slated to work with Coogler again on his reboot of the X-Files TV series. As her name was announced on Oscar Sunday, Coogler ran to the back of the Dolby Theater to find her son and carry him down the aisle to watch his mom's speech from up close. Well, good for her. Displaced, more than 1 million people in Lebanon, nearly a quarter of the population. They were forced from their homes as Bibi struck the Tehran-backed Hezbollah militia as part of his war in Iran. Announced a diagnosis of early-stage breast cancer for White House Chief of Staff Susan Wiles on March 16th. Wiles, age 68, said she will continue working while undergoing treatment. Named an English artist, born Robin Gunningham, as the man behind guerrilla street artist Banksy by a Reuters investigation published March 13th. Banksy's reps did not immediately confirm or deny the claim. Attacked, Old Dominion University in Virginia and a synagogue in Michigan in separate incidents that occurred hours apart on March 12th. In the school shooting, one victim was killed and two injured. Sentenced 15 men to life in prison by a Moscow court on March 12th for a 24 attack at a Russian concert venue that killed 149 people, and for which the Islamic State claimed responsibility. Moving to the health section. Five symptoms neurologists say never to ignore. This piece is by Angela Haupt. It can be hard to wrap your head around all the conditions neurologists treat. Cerebrovascular disorders like stroke and carotid artery disease, seizure disorders, neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's and frontotemporal dementia, headache and facial pain disorders, movement disorders, including Parkinson's, muscle diseases, sleep-related conditions like narcolepsy, and much more. If there's a nerve somewhere, a neurologist could get involved, says Dr. Andrew Dorsch, Division Chief for the General Neurology, or for General Neurology at Rush University's System for Health, and a neurological rehabilitation specialist. And there's nerves everywhere in the body. There's a lot of things that can go wrong with the nervous system, and it can take quite the detective work to figure it out. Often, he adds, people brush off neurological symptoms for a long time, pinning their symptoms on age-related aches and pains or assuming they'll resolve on their own. That could be a mistake. We asked four neurologists which symptoms you should never ignore and what they might signal. Weakness in one hand or leg. If you're dragging one leg behind you or having trouble writing with your dominant hand, schedule a doctor's appointment. People come months after their symptoms start, but weakness is one you can't ignore, says Dr. Louise Cruz Saavedra, a neurologist with Memorial Hermann Health System. A lot of people think, oh, it's just a pinched nerve, but it could actually be a stroke. It could be a brain tumor. It could be a disorder like multiple sclerosis. It could be any sort of brain inflammation. Next, difficulty getting out of a chair on a regular basis. As people get older, they tend to develop problems with daily movement. Some complaints stand apart. However, if you're regularly having trouble getting out of your chair, it's a good idea to schedule a doctor's appointment. Sure, there could be some joint issues, but we really want to take a look and make sure you don't have an issue with your muscles or your nerves or your spinal cord, Dorsch says. That's something I would want a family member to get checked out. Problems with speech. Stroke is a major cause of death in the U.S., yet people often delay seeking care. I hear all the time that someone's having stroke symptoms. And the reaction is, well, I'm going to take a nap and see if they go away, says Dr. Enrique Lira, director of the Division of Cerebrovascular Diseases at the University of Iowa. One way these urgent symptoms manifest, trouble speaking. People might start slurring the words, speaking slowly, experiencing difficulty finding words, or even be unable to comprehend what others are saying, Lira says. Next up, a sense of deja vu. Everybody experiences deja vu, the uncanny sense that something has happened before, from time to time. But if you're having episodes of deja vu on a regular basis, you probably want to come in and get checked out, Dorsch says. That's because it could be a warning sign for a temporal lobe seizure. Dorsch recently treated a patient who was having recurring episodes every week or every couple of weeks, which is not how often people usually get deja vu, he says. Next and lastly, persistent muscle twitches. Everyone's muscles twitch from time to time, usually at various locations. If you experience these fasciculations in the same place consistently, however, it's worth bringing up to your doctor, says Alexandra Olaru, a neurologist at University of Maryland St. Joseph Medical Center. It's possible you could have benign fascicular syndrome, which is harmless, or a more serious condition like spinal stenosis or amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. So, some symptoms to be on the lookout for. The View. The Science of Skepticism by Nomar Efayan. Scientists once thought illness was caused by miasmas. M-I-A-S-M-A-S. Miasmas. Foul vapors that drifted through the air. For centuries, they were certain that the sun rotated around the earth. Until the 1950s, they believed lobotomies were the best way to treat mental illness. Why did we stop believing these things? In each case, skeptics used the scientific method to produce data that disproved the incumbent theory. They hypothesized, experimented, observed, analyzed, iterated, and then published the results, precipitating a shift in our collective understanding of the world. Doubt and debate are the prisms that test current ideas and help to generate new ones. Perhaps then it's good that it's now more popular than ever to be skeptical of science. At this most recent wave of skepticism is different. its loudest voices are making evidence-free claims about COVID, climate change, and vaccines, presenting personal opinions as though they are facts with no regard for experiments or data. Sounds like Kennedy. It makes a mockery of the scientific method. This is profoundly dangerous. The scientific method is the most powerful tool humans have to change the world. It's how we together convert the unknown to the known, resolving uncertainty and productivity, metabolizing scientific doubts when it arises. At its best, the scientific method consigns the worst fates that befall humans, debilitating illnesses, devastating diseases, to history. It heals the sick and feeds the hungry. Science makes miracles. American investments in science turned our country into the world's economical, or rather, turned our country into the world's economic, technological, and military superpower. According to an estimate from the National Science Foundation, as much as 85% of all U.S. GDP growth since the end of World War II is attributable to advances in science and technology. The computer or smartphone you may be reading this on would not exist but for the scientific method. The banana you ate for breakfast would have been wiped out by a devastating crop disease years ago, and the flu you had last week might have presaged your funeral this week. Without science, we would all be poorer, sicker, and less safe. If the scientific method is corrupted, we won't just stop making new miracles. We'll undo the proven discoveries of the past. Consider, for example, the increasing rejection in certain quarters of the science that led to mRNA vaccines and many childhood vaccines. Who's to say the same pseudo-arguments won't apply to life-saving cancer treatments or to anesthesia or to germ theory? It might sound alarmist to suggest that we could regress to 1900 when the average life expectancy in the United States was just over 47 years and pneumonia and influenza were the leading causes of death. But consider that measles, a deadly disease that was declared eliminated in this country in 2000, will formally lose that designation if the 1,362 cases documented in the U.S. since the start of 26 continue to spread in the weeks ahead. For context, there were 2,283 confirmed measles cases reported in the U.S. in all of 2025. Reported confirmed cases in the first 2 months of this year are already over half that number. Ignoring the overwhelming evidence of vaccine efficacy is an abandonment of the scientific method. At the same time that some in the U.S. are undermining the scientific method, the Chinese government has been investing heavily in it. In just the past decade, China has increased its spending on the scientific method through a 400-fold increase in biopharma research and development spending. China now treats a higher share of global biotech patents than the U.S. and has a similar number of novel medicines under development. If we continue to discredit the scientific method, the U.S. risks becoming an innovation desert, reliant on other countries for new medicines and technologies, and helpless to protect our own people in times of crisis, ranging from biological warfare to the next pandemic. Even more terrifying, we risk our health. We risk not having an answer when disease strikes and losing infants and children to diseases their vulnerable bodies aren't yet mature enough to withstand. We risk missing out on the next genuine evidence-backed scientific revolution. We can choose to keep our miracle machine running. We can insist that skeptics express their doubts through the scientific method in the best tradition of history's most respected scientists. Or we can continue to abandon the scientific method and throw a wrench into the gears of science, damning ourselves to a future of disease, deprivation, and decline. The Risk Report by Ian Brummer. Ian is a contributing editor. As the world watches the still unfolding U.S.-Israeli war with Iran, the government in Venezuela, a regime now much more amiable to accommodations of Trump, looks to find new footing. The remade leadership is working with Washington to revive a long, stagnant economy, and there's early progress to report. In March, Trump moved to formalize American recognition of the administration led by Delcy Rodriguez, a now pliable veteran of the old regime, by restoring U.S. diplomatic ties, which had been severed in 2019. The move not only opens the door to a normalization of Venezuela's foreign policy, it could also allow the government to access long locked up assets abroad, like the $4.8 billion in gold now held at the Bank of England and about $5 billion in drawing rights from the IMF. Though a restructuring of Venezuela's debt remains a distant prospect, Washington's formal recognition does bode well for private sector engagement with Rodriguez's government. Higher oil prices driven by war in Iran, Bibi's war, might also boost Venezuelans' recovery. One additional early sign of stability, Trump now refers to Rodriguez as the president. For now, the Trump-Rodriguez working relationship leads Venezuela's opposition leader, Maria Corina Machado, who famously gifted her 2025 Nobel Peace Prize to Trump, out in the cold. Machado has promised to return to Venezuela in the coming weeks, though she doesn't appear to have Trump's blessing to make this move. In the meantime, her refusal to engage with the Rodriguez government will further strain her relationship with the U.S. president. She has also publicly questioned the legitimacy of U.S.-backed economic reforms approved by Venezuela's current National Assembly, which risks alienating a segment of Trump's MAGA base that says Machado is in the way. Though Machado was banned from the 2024 presidential election, voluminous evidence indicated that her party's surrogate candidate handily defeated then-incumbent Nicolas Maduro, who decreed victory. Maduro remains the most popular figure in Venezuela, and credible polls suggest that if a national election were held today, she would defeat Rodriguez by more than 2-1. And she is not the country's only opposition figure. Enrique Marquez won less than 1% of the vote in 2024, but the ruling party is much more likely to negotiate with him than with Machado, making him a potential alternative. Marquez was also an invited guest at Trump's State of the Union address, a sign the White House is willing to throw weight behind figures they believe can facilitate a smooth transition. Marquez and others have time to build their political profiles. The U.S. State Department, rather, has reaffirmed Washington's commitment to a phased transition to a democratically elected government in Venezuela, which would help allow the new government to secure major new investment from abroad. But Trump's immediate focus on economic stabilization suggests new elections probably won't happen before the second half of next year. If the Rodriguez government can sustain a pragmatic working relationship with Trump, the vote could be put off even longer. In the meantime, she will try to manage a gradual political opening that establishes credibility with Washington and other foreign governments without throwing the ruling party in the country into more political turmoil. It's also possible that Rodriguez has a long-term political future. For now, any Venezuelan national election that is legitimately free and fair would produce an opposition victory. But recent polls put Rodriguez's approval rating at 37%, not far from the 40% threshold that incumbents around the world typically need to win. And if Venezuela's economy finally picks up steam and the opposition remains as divided as it has been in the past, a Rodriguez win becomes conceivable. With the war in Iran raising risks for Trump's domestic standing, he needs a positive story to tell. He hasn't had one in a long, long time. Venezuela provides one, at least until the U.S. president shifts his attention to the prospect of a dramatic change in Cuba. Health Matters by Veronique Greenwood, staff writer. There are more than 170 rhinoviruses known to science. These causes of the common cold are found in noses all around you. And while rhinovirus infections are known for yielding lots of snot and self-pity, often they cause no symptoms at all. But if rhinoviruses are relatively benign for most people, an infection can be deadly for others. The past few decades have revealed that rhinovirus infections are behind a staggering number of asthma attacks and a leading cause of flare-ups for people with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD, causing breathlessness and coughing that can become dangerous if left untreated. The differences in symptom severity don't seem to be down to the virus itself. It's pretty clear now that if you give someone with asthma or COPD a rhinovirus and then you give the same dose of rhinovirus to a healthy person, the response is quite different, says Aran Singhanayagam, a clinical scientist at Imperial College London who studies respiratory disease. To get a better understanding of why this happens, scientists have turned to nasal tissue growth in a dish, which they infect with rhinovirus. In a new paper in the journal Cell Press Blue, researchers report that if tissues' first-line defenses fail, what could have been a mild infection spirals out of control. That confirms with data from individual cells that differences in the host's immune system, not the virus behavior, are behind these effects. When dish-grown tissue catches a cold, only a handful of cells are actually infected with the virus, says Ellen Foxman, a professor of immunology at Yale School of Medicine and an author of the new paper. We see something very similar to what you would often see in a person with a mild or asymptomatic cold, she says. Only about 1% of the cells got infected. Excuse me. All cells in the tissue, though, had changed behavior. Molecules released by the infected cells, known as interferons, acted as warning signals to their comrades, causing them to activate their antiviral defenses. As a result, the virus could not spread beyond the first infected cells. What happened if that interferon signal didn't go out? Foxman and her colleagues asked. They blocked the warning using a drug and watched as something completely different unfolded. Before their eyes, the tissue started to ooze mucus, and they found that the cells began to produce signals meant to provoke inflammation. That's what you see in people with a cold or people with asthma or COPD attacks. You see excessive mucus production, and you see those inflammatory cells coming to the lung, Foxman says. The timing really matters, she continues. If that response is delayed enough to let the virus replicate and get big enough to trigger other pathways, that's when you're going to see the symptoms. Indeed, that delay agrees with what's been seen in other studies, says Nathan Bartlett, a professor at University of Newcastle in Australia in Hunter Medical Research Institute, who studies rhinovirus. We found that if you took cells from an airway that has been chronically exposed to inflammation, there's been a desensitization, he says. It just takes them a bit longer to realize that there's an infection. And so there's a delay, we saw, by about 24 hours. For rhinovirus, or a rhinovirus, that's huge. A 24-hour delay means the virus can double its numbers multiple times before neighboring cells get the message. When cells do finally respond, there's a lot more virus to fight, and the effects can be much more damaging. This new study notably involved only a subset of nasal cells. The dish-grown tissue didn't have specialized immune cells, for instance, that would be called in when an intact human nose got wind of a virus. However, the study lays out the signal cells send out when the first line of defense is missing, which Foxman hopes will help provide targets for drugs to prevent dangerous reactions to rhinovirus. The window to intervene in the inflammatory process that seems to kick off in the absence of normal signaling is very small, however. Bartlett speculates that it might make the most sense to think of a more universal treatment or even perhaps developing a vaccine. Yes, a vaccine for colds that could protect the vulnerable before complications arise. I've seen a number of papers recently that are talking about universal vaccines, he says, which might stimulate the immune system to provide protection against viruses of all kinds. Indeed, a recent study found that mice could be protected from COVID-19, influenza, and other respiratory infections with a treatment that put the immune system on high alert. If such a vaccine is ever brought to the clinic, scientists will be watching to see how it plays out with rhinovirus. We can bring rhinovirus into the conversation now, he says, because that's probably the virus we're going to be encountering, actually more than anything. So we better start thinking about it. Okay, what do we have for time? Well, actually, we have run out of time, so we're going to end it on that note. The rhinovirus. It's been a pleasure reading to you today on this eighth day of the fourth month in the year 2026. I hope you've enjoyed listening, and better still, I hope you have a wonderful day. Please do take care. My name is Fred.